Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here's what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. A French-Cameroonian writer, Charles Onana, is on trial in Paris for allegedly denying the Rwandan genocide in his book. We'll hear the nature of the allegations against him and why he's being tried in France.
Every time he uses the word genocide, he puts quotation marks, meaning that he doesn't really want to call it a genocide. And he calls this assertion that there is a genocide and there was a genocide of the Tutsis one of the greatest swindles in the history of the 20th century.
And how farmers in several African countries are losing out on bountiful harvests due to excess salt in soil.
If the salts in the soil gets too high, then it has an impact on crop yield. Also, what we refer to is soil sodification. So that's basically when there's too much sodium in the soil, then the pores in the soil, they get blocked, and then water movement into the soil and within the soil is impossible.
It's Monday, October 14th. First, we go to West Africa. A treacherous stretch of ocean from West Africa to Spain's Canary Islands is now one of the main gateways for migrants and refugees trying to reach Europe. It's also fast becoming the deadliest route in the world. The BBC World Service has gained rare access to the secretive world of people smuggling and met the migrants prepared to take the dangerous journey. Ephraim Gebreab reports for BBC Africa Eye and tells us about a man named Mohamed Ouali who's trying to make his way to the Canary Islands.
Mohamed Ouali is one of the characters who we follow, and in a way he stands for, I guess, many more. He's a man who's in his 40s, he's 40 years old, and he's got family, he's got children, and he told us that he did all types of jobs, tried to make a living, and it's been hard and difficult, and where he's been, trying to make ends meet, and he feels that he's got a lot of support system behind him, people that sort of depend on him, not just his immediate family, but, wider family in the village. And he, despite the fact that most of the people who make it onto those boats or trying to make it on those boats are usually much younger. They're sort of, late teenagers or in their 20s. Someone as Mohammed is in his 40s taking, such a massive risk and knowing that, losing his life, what this could mean to, to his family. He nevertheless decided he has no other choice, no alternatives due to the fact that there are little opportunities for him. And he is somebody who is, was willing to document with us the journey. Which is relatively rare due to the fact that he knows that the risks are extremely high, but he feels he's got no other alternative. Also, he has friends who've made it, so to speak, who've made it to Spain and who are able to send money back to their families and support them, and he just feels the pressure that he needs to provide and he needs to be able to do the same. So he is willing to risk everything, including his life.
Nobody knows what could happen to me in these waters. The evil spirit of the sea could kill me. The boat could capsize, killing everyone. If you fall into the water, what would you hold on to? The only possibility is death. But you have to take risks. If you don't have money, you don't matter. I'm their only hope. And I don't have money.
Were you able to find out what his family thinks about this? Or did he tell you what they think about his plan?
Yeah, well, he told us that he did not tell them anything. And he didn't want to concern them because there are, you know, in some of those towns and villages, there are, you know, a lot of people who have passed away. There are many, you know, many people who are mourning close relatives who haven't made it, who are, you know, who've disappeared in the ocean, who've never made it to Europe. And he didn't want to scare his wife and his children. And they would be really anxious, obviously. So he's keeping this a secret, as many other people there are doing as well. We spoke to another person who had unfortunately lost a daughter, who had plans but hadn't told her mom about her plans, that, you know, she also wanted to join one of those boats, and she has unfortunately, you know, hasn't made it, and she's one of those boats that, you know, rights groups say the numbers of boats and people disappearing are much, much higher than the official ones. And she's, her mother is obviously very, very distraught and about the fact that she wasn't able even to say goodbye to her daughter because she had left in the middle of the night without saying anything. Similarly to Muhammad himself as well, he didn't tell his family about his plans.
So what's life like then in the Canary Islands, and, you know, what awaits these people there?
The Canary Islands are obviously a major tourist destination. I mean, even a global tourist destination. Spain is one of the, you know, very popular country to go on holiday to for a lot of people in Europe. You see plenty of, you know, people sunbathing along the coast. It's hotels of all categories. However, for the people I'm, you know, we've followed, life is very different. Making ends meet is difficult. They are undocumented. They have no papers. They have no status. But on the other hand, you do see quite a lot of people from, let's say, West Africa who are in the informal sector selling along the coastline, selling, you know, glasses or other products to tourists, jerseys, being, you know, working in the hospitality industry, in, you know, hotels or agriculture as well. But in the Canary Islands specifically, it's more in the hospitality industry, you know, be it from restaurants, be it, you know, just supporting as a support role. The challenge is obviously, you know, we spoke to one man who we bumped into at the beach in the Tenerife and had a nice chat with him. And he told us that he arrived by boat as well, you know, 4 years ago. And he is now selling sunglasses by the beach. He's making an okay living. The most important thing for him is that he's able to send money home. However, you know, in his case, for example, he had his mother, unfortunately, back home in Senegal, passed away last year, and he was unable to go back and visit and see them because he's undocumented, he doesn't have any papers. So the moment he will leave the island or leave Europe, that means for him he won't be able to come back. So there are many people who are in this limbo situation where they are neither have no papers and they feel very stuck, as in they don't have an outlet, so to speak. They don't see really a plan forward how to get status and having the opportunity as well to, you know, to go back home and perhaps commute between or go back and forth between those countries is extremely difficult. And yeah, this is some of the choices that, you know, people are willing to make that they've told us.
Ephraim, the number of the people that unfortunately die trying to make this very dangerous journey is quite high. Why is it so big?
As you say, the number is quite high, and official numbers from the United Nations, for example, Migration Office, says that 800 people have died this year alone, which is about 3/4 of an increase compared to last year. However, there are other aid organizations who are saying that it's a big underestimation. The numbers are much higher, and the data is incomplete because it's very, you know, difficult to have exact information because no one really knows, you know, how many boats are actually leaving from this hundreds and hundreds of kilometer long coastline, and nobody knows how many of them disappear. You know, there's no sea rescue organization working in this area along this route. There's one, Walking Borders, and they say they work with a network of sources on the ground, and they say that the numbers alone for this, the first half of this year, could be up to 5,000 people, so which is, you know, more than five times the official number. This is from their sources. But I think the truth is that no one is actually really able to give an exact idea about the scale of the tragedy.
Right. Ephraim, your film does touch on the criminal networks behind these crossings. Tell us what you found in regards to that.
Yes. So we were able to speak to people involved in the smuggling network. And one of the persons who spoke to us under the condition of anonymity, you know, we challenged him about, you know, his criminal role that he has in, you know, in this illegal but also very deadly trade. Well, he said that there's no shortage of customers, that he has so many people to choose from, and they're all willing to pay and come, hence he doesn't necessarily see a problem with that.
If you take a big boat, one that can carry 200 to 300 people, and each of them pay around $500, we are talking about a lot of money. It's a crime. Whoever gets caught should be put in prison, but there is no solution. You will see people in the water who have died, but the boats keep going.
And how lucrative is this for people involved in it?
This is perhaps also surprising by the amount of money that is being made and traded there. According to the smuggler, he says that he takes $500 per person. And on one of those boats, you have about 200 and 300 people getting on board. So you do the math. Mohammed told us that he had to pay $1,000 to be on the boat. And so we are talking about, I think the figures, official figures talk about something like $150 million per year that is being sort of paid in total for those trips. So you can imagine, you know, the attractiveness of, you know, criminal groups and activity to be part of this, you know, to have a slice of the cake.
Ephraim Gebreab reporting. Mohammed Ouali did not succeed in his attempt to make it to Europe and was also injured during that dangerous journey. You can see BBC Africa Eye's full documentary on the BBC Africa YouTube channel. Search for Dark Waters, Africa's Deadliest Migration Route. Next, we head to Paris, where French Cameroonian writer Charles Onana is facing trial. He stands accused of complicity in contesting the Rwandan genocide, which took place in 1994. Within 100 days, about 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed. The accusations against Mr. Onana are grounded in a book he published 5 years ago, in which he described the idea that the Hutu government planned the genocide in Rwanda as one of the biggest scams of the last century. However, his lawyer says Onana does not question that the genocide took place or that Tutsis were particularly targeted. Now, in Rwanda, it is a crime to deny the genocide. And with the fact that the genocide is also officially recognized by France, it makes it an offense to deny it or minimize it under the French law. Accusations of this nature are not entirely new to Mr. Onana. In 2002, the government in Rwanda filed a lawsuit against him in Paris for yet another book co-authored with a genocide survivor and a former member of Rwanda's ruling party, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, but the case was withdrawn. Paris-based journalist Catherine Gileadi has been following the story and joined me to break these events down for us. Firstly, tell us who Charles Onana is and why he is so controversial.
Charles Onana is a journalist, he's a politist, and he wrote 7 books on the region of the Great Lakes in Africa. He is charged for 19 quotes in his most recent book, published in 2019 on this same region. The book was called, or is called, Rwanda, the Truth About Operation Turquoise, When the Archives Finally Speak. Operation Turquoise is the French army operation in Rwanda in 1994, just after the genocide. And it's highly controversial here in France because of the action of France and how it did not act to prevent the genocide under François Mitterrand's presidency.
Tell us why he's being prosecuted and what the allegations against him are and how serious they are.
He's persecuted because of several quotes in his most recent book, and those quotes include the fact that every time he uses the word genocide, he puts quotation marks, meaning that he doesn't really want to call it a genocide. And he also evokes in particular what he calls the dogma or the ideology of the genocide of the Tutsi. These are his words. And he asserts that there was no planning of such a genocide. And he calls this assertion that there is a genocide and there was a genocide of the Tutsis, one of the greatest swindles in the history of the 20th century. He also adds that the conflict and massacres in Rwanda have nothing to do with the genocide of the Jews. These are some quotes for which he is prosecuted.
So talk to us about the seriousness of this, because a number of organizations have come together to, you know, take him to court, including the International Federation for Human Rights, the League for Human Rights, and also the Rwandan community in France.
Yes, the Rwandan community actually this month is involved or has, it involves in two trials. There is Charles Onana's trial for the denial of the Tutsi genocide, but there is also the trial of Dr. Eugene Ramusio in France. He's accused of genocide and complicity of genocide. He's actually in the French court this month as well. And actually, Charles Onana is expected to be one of the defense witnesses in this trial. The link between all these stories is what we call denial of genocide. Charles Onana said on the first day of the trial on Monday, he said, "I don't deny the genocide at all, and I will never do so." He justifies the qualification of the planning of the genocide as a fraud by saying that the opposition party at the time, which was a Tutsi RPF, who is now in power, President Kagame is from this party, he said that the Tutsi actually used this name, genocide, and that they did it on a political matter. He insists on the fact that the offensive that was led by the RPF to overthrow the regime in power was what triggered the massacre of the Tutsi. It's quite a complex thing, but it's not the first time in France, which was a country really involved in Rwanda at the time, that this idea that there is no genocide of the Tutsi, because there was also a massacre of the Hutu, and why would not it be a genocide as well, has come up.
So there's a lot that's been happening in terms of the defense that Charles Onana has put in court in this trial. But talk to us about the seriousness of all this. Should he be found guilty or somewhere along those lines?
Well, it would be the first time that someone is actually found guilty in France for denial of the Rwanda genocide. So it's quite important for those who decided to bring him to court that there is a first, because for the moment, there has been some trials in France concerning Rwanda. Obviously, Dr. Eugene Ramusio is the eighth Rwandan to be tried in France for his participation in the genocide of the Tutsi, but he faces life imprisonment. But in terms of denial of the genocide itself, it would be the first time someone is sentenced. From the report we have of the trial and the things that are coming out, it seems that he's in a rather bad shape. It was different for the French journalist who was first charged and brought to court under this law, because court said she did not put in question the genocide of Tutsi. But here there is a book, there are quite a few quotes. The witnesses that Charles Onana has chosen do not really help him, because they show the confusion in which they are. So he could well be sentenced. Oh, it's very rare that you're sent to prison for a publishing. Either, you know, your book is sent to the pillar, meaning it's destroyed. Either you can publish it again, but you have to take those quotes out.
Has that happened before in France, where a trial of this nature?
It has happened in France for the genocide of the Jews during Second World War. What we call les négationnistes, the deniers, have been quite numerous in history since the 1960s, and especially people who called themselves historians and who denied the camps, or at least what they were used for by the Nazis. And those people have been condemned, but never to prison. They had their books destroyed or forbidden to be sold.
We do know that in Rwanda and under the Rwandan law, it is a crime to deny, downplay, or even attempt to justify the genocide. Mm-hmm. Tell us how that sort of got adopted to France and why this trial is happening in France.
France has a strong connection with Rwanda, and it has always had, and it is now proven by historians that the government of the time under President François Mitterrand, unfortunately, did not act or even helped by not acting the genocide of the Tutsi. So, but it's always been a French dispute as well. You have a former minister for foreign affairs, Hubert Védrine of François Mitterrand, who says it's not true that the French did not let the Hutu perpetuate this genocide, that the massacre was on both sides, not just the Tutsi, but also the Hutu. So this is something that is really dividing here in France. And it's also because lots of Rwandans have emigrated to France or are refugee here in France.
Have there been other cases then of this genocide and the deniers of it outside of France?
As Charles Onana is being prosecuted in France, we just heard about a YouTuber, Rachid Akuzimana, who has been sentenced to 7 years in prison in Rwanda for denial. It is not the law here in France. He will not go to prison, because also the court that is prosecuting him, it's a law on the press and the publishing. So we call it Assize Court.
What precedent is being set here for anyone that would deny the Rwandan genocide against the Tutsi in the future?
It would be a precedent, because it means France recognizes this genocide as a genocide, like the Shoah or the Holocaust is recognized as a genocide, the Armenian 1915 genocide, etc.
Journalist Catherine Gileadi. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Ever heard of the phrase, too much of anything is poisonous? Well, this next story is an example of exactly that. Farmers in Ghana's southeast coastal region are losing their crops to excess levels of salt in the soil. The thing is, soil usually has salt in it, but if the salt is too much, it can suppress the growth of plants. These saline soils, as they are known, can affect food production and threaten food security. So in Ghana, the affected farmers are responding by switching to crops that are tolerant to high levels of salt in soil. A few of them sent us their thoughts on how they've had to adjust.
My name is Amos Ewua. I'm a rice farmer. Soil salinity has affected our income a lot, because most of the times when we plant and the salinity in the soil increases, we normally have reduced yield. We had a lot of training on it from the sector government. They told us the types of variety that is able to also withstand soil salinity and how we can make use of other organic materials in our area to reduce the soil salinity in our soils.
What I grow is rice. Formerly, it was tomato. But because the soils were having problems, we switched to rice. We realized when you grow the tomatoes, when it is fruiting, flowering, it will die. Others were, they were doing onion, pepper, then garden eggs. It's the same thing. We have agronomists around, so they were saying it's the soil and other things. And because the growth get a fertile, the growth will be was not. So we have to switch into the rice.
The voices of some of those affected in Ghana. However, that's not the only country affected by this. South Africa, too, is trying to tackle the problem. And in fact, experts are worried that soil salinization is quickly eroding large portions of Africa's arable land. To gain a better understanding on saline soils, their impact and possible solutions, I called up Dr. Johan Barnard from the Soil Science Society of South Africa.
basically refers to the amount of salt in the soil. So if the salts in the soil gets too high, then it has an impact on crop yield. So then the yields will start to decrease. Also, what we refer to is soil sodification. So that's basically when there's too much sodium in the soil, then the pores in the soil, they get blocked, and then water movement into the soil and within the soil is impossible.
Right. So I noticed you said too much sodification, too much salt. So these items are supposed to be in the soil in the first place.
All soil contains salts. The problem starts when the salts in the soil accumulate over time and it reaches levels that is now too high.
And what causes this excess salt?
So basically, when you irrigate, you're adding huge amount of quantities of salt to the soil because all water contains salts. The concentration of the salts will vary. So it's the amount of water that you irrigate to the crop that causes the salt to accumulate in the soil because the water goes back to the atmosphere, but the plant only uses a small amount of salts. So over time, these salts accumulate in the soil. So across the globe, especially in arid and semi-arid regions where rainfall is limited and where you irrigate a lot, then you have salts accumulating in the soil.
So when you have too much salt in the soil, then how does that affect farming and agricultural productivity?
Each crop that you plant has its own threshold level. When the salt reaches a specific level, then your yield that you will harvest will start to decrease.
Are there signs? Maybe you could use an example of a common crop that farmed across Africa to explain how excess salt in the soil might affect it.
We can use maize as an example. Symptoms would be it looks like the crop is stressing because of water stress. The leaves would typically fold in. You will see it doesn't look nice and green, and the crop actually dies because of water stress. And unfortunately, when you visually see symptoms on the plant, then normally it's too late. Then that plant is already under stress and your yield have already started to decrease.
Are there some certain crops that are more resistant to the higher levels of salt?
So peas, carrots, vegetable type of crops, they would be more sensitive to salts. And then in between the medium tolerant crops would be maize and groundnuts, and stuff like that, soybeans. And then your more tolerant crops would be then cotton, wheat and barley. If a farmer knows that his water quality is not good, I would rather advise him to plant the more tolerant crops.
And Johan, are there specific regions in Africa where this is quite prevalent?
What we say arid and semi-arid, it is regions that has, let's say, less than 400 millimeters of rainfall in a year. They are very prone to salt accumulation. Irrigation are normally associated with the drier regions. That's where you irrigate. So that's where the problems will be as well.
What are countries like South Africa doing to mitigate and adapt to the effects of what we are talking about?
Food and Agricultural Organization, that's an international organization. They've got real practical on-farm guidelines on how to manage the salts. In South Africa, we've also recently, they've developed irrigation water quality guidelines, which is a software that is freely available to everyone in South Africa. And then the software will tell you whether you can use that water to irrigate. And on-farm stuff that the farmers can do before they really run into problems is to use efficient irrigation systems. So that would be typically sprinkler irrigation rather than flood irrigation. So the idea is to minimize the amount of water that you irrigate. And then that's a more advanced level is then to intercept these leaching waters and drainage waters and reuse it again, plant more salt-tolerant crops maybe. So we talk about best management practices that a farmer can follow.
Do you think there's a good understanding that these farmers know, especially among in farming communities where this is a problem, what is happening, and therefore it would come to them that they can take the soil to the lab, that they can take the water to the lab, or they can apply some of those solutions that you are talking about?
In South Africa, the regions where salinity are in high concentrations of salt in the water is a problem, those farmers would be more aware. But in general, yeah, I don't think farmers are that aware. Although there's a lot of research, very nice guidelines that have been developed.
Tell me if there's a climate change angle to this that leads to having more salt in the soil.
Best way to remove the salts would be with rainwater. And so if climate patterns change and rainfall patterns change, then it might be that areas becomes very drier with little rainfall, and salt might become a big problem in those areas.
Many thanks to Dr. Johan Barnard from the Soil Science Society of South Africa. Focus on Africa was put together by Amy Leibovitz, Nyasha Michelle, Patricia Whitehorn, and Yvette Togira Maria in London, with Susan Gashoe being here in Nairobi. Paul Bachibinga was our senior producer, and Chris Kuzaris was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Charles Gitonga. We'll speak again next time.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.